This is The Scoop, a weekly regional roundup of stories from remote radio stations in British Columbia. Each week, The Scoop features news created by fellow LJI journalists in the communities of Smithers, Prince George, Nanaimo, Burnaby, and the Comox Valley. LJI is the local journalism initiative, and it's how your best local news is funded on these participating stations. Now, let's see what's happening this week in BC.
Today in The Scoop, the new Westminster Mayor Patrick Johnstone will seek re-election in the next municipal election this fall. Danny Nesvarandi at CJSF in Burnaby has more. The SLAM program at Shane Lake is attempting to prevent young amphibians from being crushed or otherwise impacted within UNBC's land trust and is hoping to raise funds with a new campaign. Ian Gregg at CIFR Radio in Prince George has that story. In the face of a global biological crisis, a Vancouver Island research group is using new environmental DNA to help better understand some of the coast's smallest fish. Lauren McKenzie at CHLY Nanaimo dives in. And in Kitimat, as LNG Canada and the community prepares for the second phase of the project, nearly doubling its output, District of Kitimat Councillor Terry Marlew says that residents are weighing the economic benefits against ongoing concerns like flaring, noise and air quality, and the strain on infrastructure. Pam Hassan at CICK News reports. I'm Daniel Messick and you're listening to The Scoop.
Reporting from New Westminster, BC, this is Danny Nesvarandi, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. On March 31st, New Westminster Mayor Patrick Johnstone announced that he will be seeking re-election in the city's upcoming municipal election later this year in October. The announcement took place inside Pizzeria Ludica, a local pizza restaurant in New Westminster, and shortly after doors opened, the restaurant was packed with fellow city staff, councillors, and supporters of Mayor Johnstone and Community First New Westminster, the municipal political party that Mayor Johnstone is a part of. CJSF attended the event, and before the official announcement, we spoke with Mayor Johnstone about his plans to run for a second term as Mayor of New Westminster. The first question we asked is, why are you running for mayor?
Because I love the city. I'm really proud of the work that we've done in the last 3.5-4 years in the city, and I recognize that we've got a lot more work to do. So I think that we've got a great team and we're creating great momentum in New Westminster, and I want to keep that momentum moving.
We then asked Mayor Johnstone if he has plans to change the way things are currently being governed in City Hall if elected once again in October.
I think the biggest thing is we are on a great momentum right now and we want to keep on moving it forward. We're doing great work on affordable housing in this city. We've got 3 affordable housing projects under construction right now. We've done so much work on renter protections and doing that kind of work to deal with affordable housing. Yet we still have seniors afraid about being able to age in place. We still have young families who can't get that extra bedroom when they have another kid. We've got people living on the street in New Westminster. So we have more work to do on that front. I'm really excited about the next phase in recreation investments in the city and parks and recreation spaces. We just introduced our new parks and recreation plan and we can now start building some of those facilities. Excited about that work. I'm excited about a Vision Zero work and making our roads safer. I'm excited about our momentum on climate action and youth empowerment in the city. There's a lot of good things going on in this city, but we just need to keep moving forward.
Since becoming mayor in 2022, Johnstone and the councillors affiliated with Community First New Westminster have held a majority on council, with city councillors Daniel Fontaine and Paul Minhas representing the New West Progressives, a party that is often in public opposition with Community First. Councillor Fontaine, who is regularly debated with Mayor Johnstone over council decisions, has also announced that he will be running for mayor at the end of this year. And we asked Mayor Johnstone if that has had any effect on the council's dynamic or governance leading up to the next municipal election.
I mean, there's a lot of debate in council, and there's a lot of spirited debate on council, but ultimately we're still getting the work done. I'm glad that we have a majority of people on council who vote for affordable housing, who vote for climate action, who vote for our great approach to community engagement. We've got a lot of positive work going on at council, and the majority of council is voting for it, and that's important. debate's important. It's important to make sure that we're checking on the work that we're doing and checking with the community all the time on the work we're doing. But we don't want to let it stop our momentum.
After a row of speakers from community members to city councilors, Johnstone went up last and gave the official announcement that he'll be running for mayor for a second term in New Westminster. This has been Danny Nesvetterani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM. This initiative is made possible by the Community Radio Fund of Canada through the Local Journalism Initiatives program. Find our news stories online at frequencynews.ca or cfur.ca. Joining us in studio today is Ashley Sutherland, who's the Assistant Forest Manager at the Eliza Lake Research Forest, nonprofit, but yes. You are existing within the walls of UNBC.
Yes, exactly, and very much integrated into the communities. So gotcha. a little bit of both, but
okay, great.
Formal thanks. Separation.
Yeah. Appreciate the clarity. So it's outside of city limits, Eliza Lake, but you are working on a project that is inside city limits, which is real interesting for us here at UMBC, because you're looking at Shane Lake through the Shane Lake Amphibian Migration Project. This past year of 2025, you got a foundational set of data figured out. To start off for listeners, though, why is it important to be looking at where amphibians are around Shane Lake? Why should we care about these little slimy creatures that sometimes scare us when we try to pick them up or someone chases us around with them?
Well, first off, I guess we should care about amphibians because we share the planet with them, and we should care about all things that we share the planet with. Yeah, so we're looking at where they're occurring on the trail system around Shane Lake, because what I've noticed when I've been out there on my own recreating is that amphibians are finding their way onto the trail, and because of their numbers, maybe, and possibly also because they're very difficult to see when they're newly emerged toadlets, so just transformed from tadpoles that year, that they're so tiny, and they blend very well with the trail substrate, and often people are walking the trail and they don't realize until they have maybe already trampled on some toadlets. And I'm trying to draw attention to this concern and maybe change public opinion and educate a little bit.
Sometimes we head out to Forest for the World or Shane Lake and we think we're getting out of the city. Oh, it feels so good to be in the nature, and that's absolutely true. But then all of a sudden we are in that different environment, and we have to interact with things perhaps a little more carefully than we're used to on a cement sidewalk.
Yes, absolutely. So we've got actually some really beautiful habitat that's seems to be quite healthy right now for amphibians and other creatures that live in the area. And part of the goal of the project is just raising awareness about sharing our recreational space with amphibians and I guess ultimately, I suppose, all of the animals that live there. It's just amphibians happen to be the sort of poster child of the project. Mm-hmm. And what are the vulnerabilities and where can we mitigate those impacts?
Before I get into kind of how you're assessing the situation, you mentioned it is a remarkably healthy ecosystem. What is it about Shane Lake that drew your focus to this project? Why did you decide to focus on Shane Lake in terms of amphibians?
I was there as a recreator with my dogs in 2022, and I witnessed this myself for the very first time with toadlets all over the trail, and there was no signage. Nobody was stopping and turning around and going the other direction when they encountered them. At least this was what I was observing anyway. I became highly upset by this. I went back to my vehicle in the parking lot and I emailed the city saying, this is crazy, do something about it. And nothing really happened. And then I ended up at a job that allowed me to sort of pursue this passion project as an aspect of my work. Really, I focused on Shane Lake, well, because I've observed it there, even though I know that this is a concern so many other places, But in addition to that, my employer, Aliza Lake Research Forest Society, is partnered with UNBC, and the south end of the project area is on UNBC endowment land. And it's just kind of a natural fit in terms of a partnership. And the mandate of the research forest is like research, education, community outreach. And it's just kind of a natural fit with what we do. And I mean, maybe one day SLAM will reach out to other areas. I know there is a need so many other places, and maybe SLAM will grow to other places.
But for now, Shane Lake has, you know, the familiarity, the access, and the traffic. It's a great case study.
Absolutely.
And with the strength of this, perhaps you will be able to expand to other areas.
Totally. Yeah, and being that it's a very popular recreation area within city limits, it's, I think the biologist that's been advising on this project, this is what he's said, so I'm not directly quoting him, but close, that it's a great place to observe the interaction between humans and the natural environment because of its accessibility.
One of the remarkable harbingers of spring, when things continue to warm up a little further down the road, is seeing all the amphibians emerge out of the environment and out of the forest. It's one of those remarkable things that we actually get to witness where we're living here in Prince George, Clearly today.
Yep.
So I understand, to quantify that, you've hired surveyors through this program to survey the loop trail around Shane Lake, which is in the Forest for the World Municipal Park, adjacent to UMBC, or the University of Northern British Columbia. And the surveyor identifies all the various areas that are significant sections of habitat, keeping a keen eye out for toadlet crossings. But if I understand correctly, one of the ways that community members can contribute to the project is through the iNaturalist app. Is that right? And today's March 20th. And this happens to be the anniversary of iNaturalist app. Is that right?
Yeah. So today is the 18th birthday of iNaturalist. 18 years ago today, the first observation was uploaded to iNaturalist. And that is a way that any member of the public, if they're visiting Shane Lake, may contribute to observations of the Shane Lake Amphibian Migration Project through community science.
Right. And once upon a time, projects like this were totally reliant on funding or a grant of some kind, and then specifically research being hired to collect minuscule data, which took very long lengths of time to get data to then make a difference. But in this way, individual community members are empowered to actually participate in programs like this. And should we choose, we can observe amphibian activity as well and report it to your project and help the whole thing kind of get traction.
Absolutely. Anybody, a member of the Shane Lake Amphibian Migration Project team via use of the iNaturalist app.
Effective participation through using your smartphone for perhaps a force of good.
Yes.
It's still possible.
Absolutely.
With these smartphones. We can still do something positive
with them. It's not all evil.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's one aspect of how community members can actually contribute to tracking and observing amphibian data around the Shane Lake area. And this project also has another area of community outreach as well. I understand this summer you're moving into Active Minds Camp, which is a youth camp here at the university.
Yep. It's at this stage more just ideas. But some ideas are maybe some guest lectures, maybe going out with the day camp participants and doing like little mock surveys with them, teaching them about amphibians in the natural environment, teaching them about the vulnerabilities that they face. And I'm hoping we can really teach people about, if they must handle amphibians, what is a safe way of doing that. Amphibians, one of their biggest vulnerabilities is that they breathe through their skin. So when they are handled, even the oils on the skin can really harm their health, but especially if people are handling them with bug sprays or sunscreens, which a lot of people, when they're out in the natural environment, have on their bodies. If amphibians are being handled and coming into contact with those toxins, that is really, really detrimental to their health. So I'm hoping that we can integrate some aspects of safe handling if we must. Of course, we don't want to encourage handling, but if we must, we like to observe just with our eyes. But if we must handle them, how can we do it as safe as possible for the critters that we're handling.
So a little side note, running contrary to popular urban myth, you might actually be giving the toad toxins.
Totally. It goes the other way.
Yeah.
Yeah. At least, you know, at least with the species in this region are the ones I can speak to.
Certainly. Yeah.
Yeah.
You don't have the poison arrow dart frogs in Prince George Shane Lake.
No. Yeah. Luckily. Yeah. Lucky for us.
This is Ian Gregg reporting for CIFA Radio's Due North on 88.7 FM.
This is a CHY News update. In the face of a global biological crisis, a Vancouver Island research group is using new environmental DNA techniques to help better understand some of the coast's smallest fish. Project Watershed, located out of the Comox Valley, has been monitoring surfsmelt and Pacific sand lance, two different species of forage fish found around the coast of Vancouver Island. While these fish may be small and less desirable for humans to eat, these fish are valuable parts of the ocean ecosystem, as they are food for some of the ocean's top predators. In monitoring the population of forage fish along the Salish Sea, Project Watershed joined a team of researchers at the University of Victoria to find new methods for collecting environmental DNA. Jacqueline Huard, Forage Fish Project Lead at Project Watershed, says environmental DNA, or eDNA, is DNA collected not directly from an animal, but from environmental samples such as soil, water, air, and snow.
So as any animal, but especially fish that we're focused on, as they move through their environment, they're constantly sloughing off and like shedding bits of DNA. So it could be from hair, or in the case of fish, it'd be like scales or slime, or especially when they're spawning and they're dropping eggs or sperm into the environment, like it's just full of DNA. And so we can go around and pick up water or sand and then look for traces of DNA in that sample.
For the last 8 years, Project Watershed has been using eDNA to detect tiny traces of genetic materials fish leave behind on the sand at beaches.
And so right now, when we go to a beach, usually we collect about a cup of sand from each beach, which is like made up of many tiny little scoops, you know, like 30 to 100 little scoops across the beach of sand. And then we take that sand, we put it in the freezer, and we get it down to her lab, or right now when we're using many, many samples, we send it to another lab all the way in Guelph. And then they look in that sand for DNA of sand lance and surf smelt.
They have been sampling beaches around Vancouver Island to collect and monitor the eDNA left by the forage fish. One small hurdle in research occurred when some local First Nations did not want materials removed from their territories due to cultural significance or a site being sacred. This included sand from beaches. Temporarily, eDNA monitoring was halted until a culturally respective solution could be found. From this, Project Watershed worked with the forage fish researchers at the University of Victoria and developed a new collection method called the floppy dip.
It's like a special piece of paper. It's like the size of a toonie and it's charged, and so it can grab DNA. And so what we do is we go along the beach, we collect the sand as if we normally would. We put it in a Ziploc bag, very high-tech tools, and then we add some regular drinking water that would have no chance of having come across their DNA before. So we add that in, we add in that special piece of paper, and we shake it around. You shake it around for a minute. I like to think of it as our shake and bake technique. And then we take that piece of paper out and we add it to like a little envelope with some silica packs, and we send that to the lab instead of the sand, and the sand can get put back on the beach immediately. We don't have to take it away from the beach at all.
Huard says while different species of forage fish can be found around the world, with some countries heavily researching the fish or even commercially fishing them, there are still a lot of unknowns when it comes to local species.
About them, and we're gaining more momentum for where these species are and like what predators eat them and how important they are to the ecosystem. But it's still largely a mystery. We don't know how well the populations are doing. We don't know if they're growing or collapsing.
They say that monitoring and understanding these fish means supporting other species like salmon, whales, and the endangered marbled murrelet that use the fish as food. Huard says that with their eDNA data, they have been able to create a habitat sustainability model for forage fish on the Salish Sea.
And that habitat suitability model, built on citizen science data, is now being used by DFO and other land managers like First Nations or regional areas, but especially by DFO in their, essentially their permitting department, when they're looking at whether or not a project should go forward. So if someone says, hey, we want to build a dock here, or hey, we want to build this big terminal, like RBT2, Roberts Bank Terminal 2, DFO now has a tool to look at and say, hey, is there habitat for specific sandlands here? When previously sandy habitats were not considered to be used by a lot of fish, and so it wasn't really that like highly valued by managers.
With this model, Huard said it helped mitigate the impacts to the local forage fish habitats. Now, Project Watershed is working to create a habitat sustainability model for the west coast of Vancouver Island. After collecting data for the last 3 years, they hope in future years they'll be able to conduct further research and build sustainability models for the Queen Charlotte Strait, Queen Charlotte Sound, and the Central Coast and Haida Gwaii area.
As you might imagine, there are there's First Nations everywhere, but they dominate for sure in the North and Central Coasts in terms of like land managers. And I think that there will be more places where we will need to use this technique so that we're not taking sand away from the beaches.
Huard says that not monitoring forage fish creates an unknown. Lack of monitoring these key species could lead to devastating but preventable effects on the ocean ecosystems if they were to collapse before action can be taken. For CHY News, this is Laura McKenzie.
This is CICK News. In Kitimat, the next phase of one of Canada's largest energy projects is no longer hypothetical, it's underway. LNG Canada's Phase 2 expansion has now cleared a critical threshold. Approval agreements have been signed. In practical terms, that doesn't mean construction crews arrive tomorrow, but it does mean that senior partners, regulators, and governments have aligned on the conditions required to move forward. These agreements typically lock in environmental compliance commitments, confirm permitting pathways, outline infrastructure responsibilities, and signal to investors that the project has enough certainty to proceed toward a final investment decision. In short, the groundwork, legally, politically, and financially, is now in place. I spoke with Terry Marlowe, a second-term councillor in the District of Kitimat, about what those approvals mean for a community still adjusting to Phase 1. While the expansion promises jobs and long-term economic growth, Marlowe says it also intensifies existing pressures, from persistent flare stack noise and air quality concerns to housing, infrastructure strain, and rising municipal costs. At the same time, global forces from shifting energy demand to geopolitical supply disruptions are accelerating timelines in ways that can feel far removed from local decision-making. In Kitimat, Phase 2 isn't just another project milestone. It's a test of whether the systems built during Phase 1, environmental monitoring, community oversight, and municipal planning, are strong enough to handle what comes next.
I'm Terry Marlowe. I'm councillor in the District of Kitimat. This is my second term as a councillor.
First off, thanks so much for making the time to speak with me. I wanted to speak to you about a March 9th presentation from LNG Canada to Kitimat Council. What stood out to you about the timeline or the presentation or even urgency you were getting from LNG Canada in that council meeting?
We were hearing a lot of, in some places, concerns, other cases, just inquiry from people that lived in our community at the, you know, the flare, for example, and a lot of noise coming from the flare stack. And like anything in industry, there's also wonders and concerns about, is there any kind of, you know, products that are coming out that may be of a concern to the local citizens? So going into that, I think they really wanted to try and clarify some of their studies they had, some of the airshed testing that had been going on. They've got a number of sites around the community in the valley where they're doing constant monitoring of various types. And I think they went through the March 9th open meeting to council and the public very well, and in fact really went through it with detail. Just leading up to that, I'd mentioned that we had a meeting prior, and there is a discussion as well of, because I'd also asked the question probably a few months prior to that when LNG had also done a presentation about concerns about the flare stack and the tip because I'd heard some word from a few people about that. And so they basically had said back then that they were looking into a few things, but things were good. But in our meeting, we talked in a little bit more detail just about the flare tip and then the fact that although I trust that LNG is overly cautious and making sure that that safety is a critical thing for them, and we've seen nothing but that when they've been here. They've been very good with safety for our community, but they were having some issues with on the top of their flare. They basically have kind of four different outlets at the tip of the flare, and I think one is called the warm wet based on the material that comes out there. A couple of others are to do filling tanks and some other things. And then there's a fourth one is basically a spare. And as a person dealing with science in my classrooms and all that, I compared it to almost like a Bunsen burner. You see the burning outside. You don't want it obviously to burn inside, or it could be a problem. And so what they found is that because of this, they had checked all the rest of the plant because of the noise that was happening, and some of the concerns of citizens, and basically found that nothing else in any other parts of the production facilities were there problems. And basically it had narrowed it indeed to the flare tip. And so what they're doing is at one point they actually switched from that main one flare tip over to the other arm and that spare, and that's what they're operating on right now. Mm-hmm. They work on looking at basically replacing the tip, ordering replacement flare tips of a different type and a different material. So that's some of the discussion that we had. I think that the assurances were there based on all of the testing and all the sites where they had the airshed testing in around the community, that any kind of increases in those products like the NOx and the SO2s are, you know, of a very tiny amount, and certainly not anywhere near what the regulators are suggesting that they have to make sure that they stay under. And they also seem to assure that if they do go on to phase two, that it still would be well below that.
Are you getting a sense that actually things have changed since March 9th? Phase two seems like it's accelerating pretty quickly. How are you hearing from residents about that? Are people feeling optimistic, concerned, or maybe even fatigue after phase one? What are you kind of hearing from residents about the acceleration of phase two of LNG Canada and Kitimat?
I would say all of the above. You hit it pretty well. I think that a number of people are happy because obviously with LNG coming here, we have long-term jobs in terms of people working there, but shorter term over years of work for contractors and other support groups around to help build and work safely around the facility. So bringing that on will mean even more of those jobs for a period of time. There are some who've obviously been concerned, really, especially those that live, say, in the Strawberry Meadows area, some of those that are closer to where across the water from where the plant is, that are hearing the brunt of the noise and seeing most of the flaring and things like that. And then some that, like anything, you know, it creates a lot of traffic and a lot of things going on in town. So some people say, when's it done? But I think generally everybody overall is supportive of Canada LNG, but obviously want to see it done in a way that's not going to cause us any problems within our valley. We do have, as a caveat, two major industries that do give off a lot of gases, work with a lot of metals and a lot of things like that. So it's always one that you're going, just make sure you do it right, because we don't want our valley to be certainly polluted or those kinds of things to a level that nobody wants to live here.
What about the actual infrastructure in Kitimat, logistically and socially, like for phase two, another major construction phase of this scale? Do you feel like Kitimat has the housing, healthcare, workforce infrastructure in place?
A few things. There was obviously let's go back a ways, when Rio Tinto did their upgrade, that was the first of the major changes and upgrades or building that we had in some time in Kitimat for industry. And there was certainly concern there was, are they going to overwhelm our hospital, for example, if there's issues there? Will there be problems in terms of crime? You got a lot of construction workers coming to town, just concerns of what it may bring in terms of crime, maybe impact on women, for example, in the community.
Thank you to District of Kitimat Councillor Terry Marlowe for taking the time to speak with me today. CSK News is funded by the Government of Canada, the Community Radio Fund of Canada, and is a participating station in the Local Journalism Initiative. On behalf of my colleague Dan Messick and myself, Pam Hassan, thanks for listening. That's it for this week's Scoop. Catch us next week, Thursdays at 12 p.m. in Smithers, Thursdays at 4 p.m. in Burnaby, Fridays at 8 a.m. in Nanaimo, and weekdays at 7:30 in Prince George. The Scoop was made possible by funding from the Canadian government and the Local Journalism Initiative, a Community Radio Fund of Canada initiative.